Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week my guest is Yung Chang, the author, as everybody will remember, of the multi-zillion-selling Wild Swans, and subsequently of an enormously authoritative biography of Mao. Her new book is called Big Sister, Little Sister, Red Sister, Three Women at the Heart of 20th Century China. But these are not Wild Swan-type women. These are, you know, who are ordinary women. These are women who are the absolute heart of the Chinese 20th century. They are the remarkable Sung sisters. And Yung, can you start by just explaining a little about who these three women were?
These three sisters from the Sung family were born in the late years of the 19th century. And they were born in Shanghai. Their parents were devout Christians, and they were all educated in America. They came back to China, and they made extraordinary marriages. One married Red Sister, Qingling, married Sun Yaxian, who in the Chinese-speaking world is regarded as father of China. Little Sister Mei Ling married Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Nationalist China, and she was the first lady of Nationalist China for 22 years, and then the first lady of Taiwan. And Big Sister Ai Ling made herself one of the richest women in China, and her husband was Chiang Kai-shek's prime minister and finance minister for many years. Big Sister and Little Sister were at the core of Chiang Kai-shek's regime. In fact, Big Sister was like Chiang Kai-shek's closest advisor. And Red Sister Qingling rose to become Mao's vice chair and was the honorary president of China when she died.
And having written the books you've written previously, what was it that brought you to these three women as a subject?
When my last book, a biography of Empress Dowager Cixi, was published, I was thinking about my next subject. And at the time, I resisted the idea of writing about the Song sisters because they were very much fairy tale figures and unreal figures. And there is a cliche, well-known cliche, which says, and there are three sisters in China. One loves money, one loves power, and one loves the country. So instead, I decided to write about Sun Yaxian. I wanted to write about another program setter, somebody who made policies and changed the course of China, the history of China. And Mao, both Mao and Cixi, the Empress Dowager, were policy makers. And Sun Yaxian was also one. And he was a kind of bridge between the Empress Dowager and Mao. And so I started to write about him. But after I've gathered a lot of materials, I lost interest in him because I felt he was too single-mindedly focused on power. He was entirely driven by the pursuit of power. And in a way, that's uninteresting. I mean, I wrote about Mao. You know, I spent 12 years of my life writing about Mao. And there is a sense of déjà vu. And so I... But instead, his wife, Sun Yaxian's wife, and her sisters emerged as really interesting and extraordinary. And I discovered a lot of things about them which made them alive. And they become real human beings to me. And I'm sort of fascinated. And I decided to change my subject to the three sisters.
And these three sisters, I'm interested in what the received ideas of them were. You know, you said you grew up with them as fairy tale figures, and, you know, one loved power, one loved money, one loved her country. presumably, when you were growing up, the one who loved her country was held to be Qing Ling, Red Sister.
Yes.
But were the other two, you know, obviously the other two were essentially on the nationalist side, they were associated with the Kuomintang and with Taiwan. Were they seen as villains? I mean, how was the ideological shaping of these three sisters?
Yes, big sister and little sister were seen at my time growing up in China in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. They were villains. There was a well-known story that little sister bathed every day in milk to make her skin good. And we all firmly believed the story. And I remember one day a teacher tried to correct this image, this sort of myth. And he said, "Do you really think bathing in milk is pleasant?" And soon, of course, he was condemned as a rightist in, you know, one of Mao's political campaigns.
Didn't take much.
But now, I mean, things have changed. And then China wanted to court Taiwan, to bring Taiwan into its fold. And so they were not too harsh on the two, the big sister and the little sister.
Yeah. And in terms of what you were able to discover to get to the heart of their stories, you know, what sort of sources were available and how did they change, if you like, the received or the official story of them?
And there are a lot of materials about the three sisters. They were all educated in America. So American archives and libraries played a big role in my research. And I can't tell you what a relief this is, having done research in the biography of Mao and Empress Dowager, and because the archives were so helpful. I mean, the sisters' colleges have their archives. Chiang Kai-shek, for example, wrote a diary for 57 years and every day. And his diaries are in at Hoover Institute in Stanford. And there were a lot of oral history materials at Columbia University, lots of archives. In Britain, the National Archives at Kew also had a lot of materials on particularly Sun Yat-sen.
How easy was it to find the sisters' voices, their own words or their own viewpoints?
The sisters wrote a lot. They wrote letters. I mean, in those days, people wrote letters constantly, and they wrote loads and loads of letters. And those letters were extremely revealing. And there were a lot of these letters. Of course, I mean, Taiwan is a major source. Taiwan, being a democracy, has opened its archives. And even in mainland China, there has been a lot of research on the sisters, and a lot of things were published. So I can approach all these sources with, you know, extraordinary ease compared to how I did my research about Mao, particularly.
How would you characterize it? Somebody on the outside, an awful lot of this seems sort of astonishing that, well, I mean, in the first place, that these three women should have ended up, you know, of all people, at the centre. You know, it was a sort of accident of history that one of them was married to Chiang Kai-shek and one of them was married to Sun and one of them, you know. And also even Sun Yat-sen, who in your earlier chapter you describe him, he comes over as almost a sort of comic figure. He's not this, you know, an important man in any sort of regime. And he goes to Hawaii and he has some ideas about republicanism and he comes back and he decides to sort of foment a revolution against the Manchu dynasty and kind of succeeds. I mean, how does that, you know, one thinks of China as an enormous place with huge structures of power and he more or less just sort of phones up a friend who's, you know, a gangster and knows some people they can call. How does that work? I mean, I'm burlesquing it a little, but it seems extraordinary that these huge movements seem to turn on such individuals.
Well, that is often the case in history. Some extraordinary changes happen. and triggered off by seemingly insignificant events. And what one thing that most extraordinary to me was how Sun Yat-sen came to be regarded as the father of China. And it's all because of the one fact that he was the first man to promote republicanism. And he picked up the idea of republicanism in Hawaii. He happened to be in Hawaii at the time when Hawaii became a republic. And republicanism was on everybody's lips. And we're talking about the end of 19th century. And so he got the idea. And of course, he pursued it doggedly for decades. Now, he was not a comic figure. I mean, there is a view that which tended to portray him as a comic figure, but absolutely not. I mean, he sometimes rather fomented this image himself for his political goals. But in fact, he was a dead serious figure, and he kind of deserved the title of the father of China, for good or bad. But China was ripe for republicanism. And the main reason was that the Manchu dynasty was regarded as a foreign rule. They were Manchus. They were 1% of the population, and they had conquered China in the 17th century from the north. So foreign rule has got to end, and that was a consensus of many people. And it was not, this was no accident. And what is the accident? Is if any other Republican had been promoting republicanism first, other than Sun Yat-sen, and China might have taken a different course of evolvement because of Sun Yat-sen's ambitions and the extent he would go to fulfill his ambitions. He introduced Soviet communism, Leninism into China to help himself, and which led to eventually a communist China.
Well, one of the things that's interesting in that respect, though, is that you write in the book, I think, Sun was not a Bolshevik. He was using Bolshevism, he was using Leninism, he was using Russia as a sort of lever for his own purposes. But of course, Qingling, after he dies, goes on to be very much in bed with Russia. Do you think she was a true believer?
I think she was. I mean, a turning point was 1922 when she had this near-death experience thanks to her husband and the life she chose. And I think that played a big role in her becoming a hardened Leninist. And it was also in that year she met with Soviet emissaries in China, and she was under their influence, particularly Borodin. And then she went into exile in Russia after Chiang Kai-shek seized the leadership of the Nationalist Party and broke from the Russians and the Chinese communists. And when she was in Russia in 1927-28, and she witnessed firsthand Stalin's power struggle with Trotsky. And the Soviet emissaries in China were sent to the Gulag, driven to suicide, and suffered appallingly. And they all had to, the old friends couldn't speak to each other. And so she was baptized by this purge culture, which kind of immuned her in a way to the subsequent purges under Mao. And she could live with those purges because she had, you know, back in the 1927-28, she had seen it all, although, of course, of different degrees.
Now, obviously, this does beg the very, you know, central question in a way is, how did they negotiate this as a family? I mean, it makes the difficulties of the Johnson families or even the Mitfords look like, you know, bagatelles, you know. One of them was married to Chiang Kai-shek. One of them was, you know, with the enemy.
Yes.
And yet they didn't. How did they negotiate that? How did their personal relationships survive?
To start with, I think their family was a very close-knit family. They were genuinely devoted to each other, the the sisters, and they also got on with each other on the personal level. They liked each other. They were tremendously fond of each other, and they had memories like, you know, Mei Ling went to America as a child. She was 9 years old. She was brought to America and looked after along the way by her sister, red sister, Qingling. So they had a lot of affections to each other. And then, yet, of course, and Qingling then devoted her life in destroying, in a way, the lives of her sisters. But I think what's extraordinary was that they respected each other's beliefs. Mei Ling said, even before she died in the later years of her life, and she had enormous respect for her red sister, who sort of kind of stood up to a mighty force, which was Chiang Kai-shek's regime, and risked the assassinations. And so they sort of respected each other's beliefs, and they also needed each other to survive. And so there was a lot of calculation in their relationships as well, because Qingling, Red Sister, was the most vocal critic of Chiang Kai-shek under Chiang Kai-shek's rule. And Chiang Kai-shek had contemplated car accidents for her.
Yes, but he didn't.
But he didn't carry it through because he was worried about his wife's reaction.
And didn't he write a letter that he then framed?
Yes.
Which is, I think she's in Moscow at the time, isn't she? And she denounces him really fiercely, and I think that's so fierce that no newspaper will publish it.
That's right, yes.
And they drop it as leaflets.
Yes, yes. And she was in Shanghai.
Oh, she was in Shanghai.
She was in Shanghai, but she told the Moscow line, and there was, and absolutely right, and Chiang Kai-shek was furious. And in fact, there was a lot of nationalistic feelings against her. But she knew that her survival depended on her sisters. Her sister's support. So she always kept a very good relationship with her sisters. And on the side of Chiang Kai-shek and the little sister and the big sister, they also needed the Sun Yat-sen's prestige to claim legitimacy. Because Chiang Kai-shek was the first Republican to come to power without an election. I mean, one thing that astonished me was that the fact that the young republic from after 1912 to 1928, when Chiang Kai-shek seized the power, in those years, China was a functioning democracy. And there were general elections, the presidents were elected, there were parliaments, there was an independent judiciary, and there were completely a free press. And actually, you know, there was a lot of, the country was living in tremendous freedom and development. And Chiang Kai-shek ended all that. He established a dictatorship, and he needed legitimacy. And he claimed Sun Yat-sen, the father of republic, for his legitimacy. So in that sense, they also had to be nice to Qingling, Madame Sun.
Just a little bit. Do you think that their relationship, I mean, you said, you know, politics sort of shaped their relationship. Did their relationships shape politics as well, do you think? I mean, do you think the course that the history took would have been different? Say, I mean, had Sun lived, or had they not had, you know, essentially had the nationalists and the communists not had a family relationship?
Not in the sense of drastically changing the course of history in China, but little sister and big sister did have benign influence on Chiang Kai-shek. They converted Chiang Kai-shek to Christianity, which led to his rule becoming much more benign. And so there were good influence on Chiang Kai-shek. I think Red Sister played little role in shaping Mao's policies.
For the better?
No, played little, very little role.
Played very little role.
She made no policy. She was more like a graceful face for the regime. And she did what she was told to do.
Yeah, you mentioned Chiang Kai-shek's being, as it were, mellowed by his wife. There's an extraordinary photograph in the book, which is a present that he gave her. It's a necklace made out of a mountain. Can you?
Yes.
There's Chiang Kai-shek, the unexpected romantic. What, you know?
Yes, this was something that surprised me because his image was this very harsh, hardline, you know, aggressive person. But in fact, he had a very imaginative and romantic side, and his relationship with his wife was absolutely extraordinary. In 1932, he gave Mei Ling this birthday present, which, as you said, is a necklace out of a whole mountain. And basically, he imported a lot of French plane trees and planted them in the shape of the chains for a necklace around a mountain. And these French plane trees changed color in autumn in a different way from the local trees. So they stood out, they stand out today in this yellow golden color, forming a distinctive necklace. And the pendant in the middle of the necklace looks like a big jewel. And that was a villa for Mei Ling. And that was called the Mei Ling Palace outside Nanjing. The roof of that palace uses certain glass or certain mineral which sparkle in the sunshine, looking like a real jewel. And you know that necklace was very little known because you could only see it in a private plane flying over. And of course, Chiang Kai-shek showed his wife, but nobody else did that. And I think it was only discovered fairly recently because nobody was allowed to take a private plane tour around over Nanjing.
He was not much of a socialist. Yes, this, at least.
And then this film crew to shoot something else, but discovered it by accident and saw this, you know, distinctive, you can see from the picture, this gigantic necklace, beautiful gigantic necklace, which is a whole mountain, and all these houses were in the middle, buildings were in the middle of the inside this necklace. And then people started to do research and found in the archives how this was built and why and so on.
That is extraordinary. And can you give me a sense of how, I mean, you know, you said you spent 12 years living with Mao, which can't be possible. Living with these three women, how did you, you know, how do you feel towards them and about them now? I mean, do you find yourself sympathetic to them? Do you go, oh, don't like that one, don't trust her? I'm just interested in biographers. You know, obviously you're a historian, you know, you write as you find, but how did your research make you feel about your subject variously?
I feel I've understood them much more now and have come to see them as real human beings. That, of course, gives me a lot of sympathy for them. I mean, they have passionate loves, but hugely let down. And Mei Ling, little sister, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, I never knew this before, had suffered a nervous breakdown for some years and was in depression, which was why Chiang Kai-shek gave her that necklace, took such trouble to make that birthday present for her. And because she had imagined her married life to be something and she could use to do a lot of good for China, as she wrote to her American friend, Emma Mills. But she was surprised because Chiang Kai-shek was so besieged as a dictator And a lot of assassins were pursuing Chiang Kai-shek, I mean, which means her as well. I mean, these assassins got into her bedroom at night, and as a result, she suffered a miscarriage and was left childless for her life. And so there were all this, and her big sister, Eileen, without going too much detail into the book, and how she had this mother-daughter, almost like relationship with little sister, because she was 10 years older, and how she, you know, when she was very corrupt, she made herself one of the richest women in China. And she developed a conviction that it was God's will for her to come to Earth and make a lot of money to provide for her two illustrious sisters. And that's how she believed, how she justified her corruption. And she was deeply religious, which was also interesting to me. I mean, she prayed all the time. She prayed before she made the investment. So they became human beings to me, and I became drawn to him, to them. Having said all that, it is a book that I felt least emotionally involved. I mean, because when I wrote Biography of Mao, because I had lived under Mao, and my father died in the Cultural Revolution, my grandmother died in the Cultural Revolution, inevitably, this emotional aspect is visible in my biography. I mean, of course, I'm fair to Mao. I've done 12 years research. It's not a book to condemn Mao, but to seek to understand him. But there is that emotional element. And when I wrote the Empress Dowager Cixi biography, and I was struck. I came to write that book because I had discovered when I was writing Wild Swans that she, the Empress Dowager, had banned foot binding in 1902, foot binding that tortured my grandmother and Chinese women, you know, for 1,000 years. And that was a complete revelation, completely different from her usual image of being this tyrant, reactionary, and so on. So I had a lot of sympathy for Empress Dowager Cixi from my research on that book. And I sort of came to admire her, because she did so much good for China. She brought China into the modern world, and she was committed to build constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament. In a way, you could say that she paved the way for republicanism at the cost of her own dynasty. And so I had a lot of sympathy, and my emotions were very much also, I think, perhaps visible in that biography. And with the three sisters, there was much less of my own emotions. But of course, I came to appreciate, for example, little sister Mei Ling's bravery. She was a very brave woman. And once when her husband was kidnapped, she risked her life to go and rescue him. And as a result, she prevented a civil war, and that would have torn China apart on the eve of Japanese invasion in 1937, and she did it in 1936. That act, in a way, would have prevented the Japanese conquest of China. So she was very brave. You know, before she walked into the kidnap, and she gave her pistol to the friend with her and asked him to shoot her if the soldiers seized her. And so I had a lot of sympathy for her. And also she was determined to leave Chiang Kai-shek many times. And when Chiang Kai-shek moved to Taiwan, she at first didn't want to go. But, I mean, there is some detail in the book, I mean, emotional torment and so on. And she did what she regarded as the right thing, which is to stand by her husband and not to lend ammunition to the communists. And she went to Taiwan and always stood by him. And she was quite brave, although she loved luxury. She had 37 servants at her old age when she lived in New York. And, you know, she
lived for a very long time, didn't she? I mean,
she lived to 105. She died after 9/11 in 2003.
Absolutely
extraordinary. Yes, it was extraordinary. And she was...
So did you ever have any contact with her? Have you ever written to her or met
she,
her?
No, I did try... With our biography, I did try to see her, but her friends told me that she declined all interviews, which was true. She never gave interviews. She never talked about herself. I mean, you know, she was, at her time, she was one of the most famous women in the world. I mean, she was on top of the world. She was at Cairo conference with her husband, with Roosevelt and Churchill. She addressed 30,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl in Hollywood. She addressed the Congress. She was the first woman to address the Congress. And she was a political figure in her own right, but she never talked about her past glories. She quoted something from the Bible to the effect that all these were vanities, and she only wanted to be buried with her sister, with her beloved big sister and her family, and didn't want to be buried with Chiang Kai-shek, didn't be put lying in state with Chiang Kai-shek.
Did she get her wish? Is she in New York?
Yes,
Taiwan?
She was like, and if you go to New York, in this cemetery for New Yorkers, and she was there in the ordinary room. Her sister, big sister Eileen, had bought two rooms in this Ferncliff cemetery, and she was in one of them. And at her burial, there was even a glitch. Her casket could not fit into the gap. And so they had to do some demolition on the spot to put her coffin in. And this was a far cry from Chiang Kai-shek's own burial, which was meticulously stage managed. And Chiang Kai-shek's coffin, I don't know whether you know this, is lying in state in Taiwan in one of his many former villas. You know, Chiang Kai-shek had 30 villas dotted around Taiwan.
So he's spoiled for choice, yes. For a resting place. And is Qing Ling in Beijing?
Qing Ling was buried in Shanghai in the cemetery with her parents. She said, and there were people who suggested that she should be buried together with Sun Yat-sen. And by the way, Sun Yat-sen's burial ground was in Nanjing. It was this gigantic thing which he had planned before he died. He wanted to be buried in that mountain next to the first emperor of Ming Dynasty. But Sun Yat-sen, wanted his tomb to be much, much higher than the Ming Emperor's tomb.
And which is a comic figure in some respects.
It was this gigantic thing. And he'd laid down many rules. I mean, this was one reason why on his bedside he endorsed a letter to the Soviet Communist Party, which was made him look far more Bolshevik than he really was. Because he wanted the Russians to teach the nationalists how to do his personality cult. Lenin had died the year before, and the personality cult for Lenin, you know, the Lenin tomb,
yeah,
the bust, the portrait, the elevation to godlike status, and all this Sun Yat-sen had registered and wanted to have for himself. And the Russians did tell the nationalists how to do his personality cult. And his tomb, his mausoleum, was part of that. But of course, he couldn't have the transparent coffin because Nanjing was too hot.
Yes.
It wouldn't work for the transparent top. But other than that, the full personality cult. And Qing Ling didn't want to be buried with her husband. She wanted to be buried with her parents, particularly her mother. She told her adopted daughter she wanted to keep apologizing to her mother because she broke from her mother by becoming a communist. And her mother disapproved of that and, in fact, tried very hard. In fact, I got a letter, you know, the owner of the letter showed me the letter from Qing Ling to her mother, which made it clear that she had written many times to her mother and her mother had refused to reply. After the mother had failed to get her back from exile in Moscow. And so she sort of broke from her, mother. And so when her mother was dying, she was in exile in Berlin and she refused to go and see her mother. And so when she got home, her mother had already died and she felt she owed her mother this. So she's now buried next to her mother.
Oh, that's sort of touching. I suppose all families have their little ups and downs.
Hmm.
Zhong Chang, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I want to let you know too about an upcoming event where I'll be talking to Robert Harris about his new novel, The Second Sleep, for a live recording of this podcast. The event takes place on Wednesday, the 23rd of October at the Emanuel Centre in Westminster. You can get tickets at spectator.co.uk/events. I very much hope you'll come and join us.